Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward. Speaking in Maine takes us today to Northport and the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, welcoming Stephen Coltai, speaking on peace through entrepreneurship. Stephen Coltai created and ran the Global Entrepreneurship Program for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, leaving to continue the work of global entrepreneurship ecosystem building via Coltai & Company. Stephen is currently a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution. He served as Senior Vice President for Strategy and Corporate Development at Warner Brothers, as a strategic planning consultant at McKinsey & Company, and as an investment banker at Salomon Brothers.
Good afternoon and welcome to the December meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you from Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. I'm Tom DeMarco, filling in for Mac DeFord, President of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983, so it's now into its 32nd year of bringing you on a monthly basis informed speakers on all aspects of foreign affairs, the U.S. diplomatic policy, often the lack thereof, details about past and upcoming programs available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The Forum is particularly pleased today to be able to bring you Stephen Coltai, the author of a new book, Peace Through Entrepreneurship, and that's going to be his topic today. Stephen founded and ran the program for global entrepreneurship for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and was also very involved in the Clinton campaign. He is just recently back from Hungary, where he is Hungarian, speaks Hungarian, has an apartment in Budapest. And last night we had a meeting with the board, and he talked to us on a slightly different subject about the rise of oligarchy in Europe and what it might imply for our experience in the United States, our coming experience. So when you think about questions, you might ask him a little bit about that as well. He comes to us with a different premise than we're used to on the subject of the Middle East and the North African Arab world. And the premise is the idea that the problems there, the crisis of that region, might not be so much a crisis of religion or of boundaries or of policy or a different outlook, but it might just be a crisis at its heart, a crisis of jobs. As he points out, the unemployment rate in much of the region is in excess of 40%, youth unemployment much higher, and that gives us an idle, unemployed, fairly hopeless population. This is from the early going Peace Through Entrepreneurship, quoting Stephen here. Millions of unemployed young people make for millions of lives stunted by economic despair. It makes for legions of frustrated, angry, idle, and impressionable teenagers and 20 and 30-somethings. It makes for instability and chaos that spills over borders into Jordan, into Israel, and into Turkey. And as we know from Paris and more, it makes for threats that spill over into Europe and into America. Could it be a crisis of jobs? And if so, Stephen, what are we going to do about it? Stephen Coltai.
Hi, everybody. It is a very special honor and privilege to be here. I consider this to be my hometown because I moved to Lincolnville from Los Angeles in 2007 and went from here to D.C. I still have a home here. So this is a very special event for me on this book tour that I'm doing this year. And in fact, it's so special that I'm having ankle surgery on Wednesday, and this is the last event I'm doing in 6 weeks, that because I will then be laying on my couch in D.C. for the next 6 weeks. So I'm really honored to be here. So many friends, and most especially my son, who is here, Nicholas, and lives in Maine. I find myself now with a lot of spare time after the election, and so I've been able to, until I broke my ankle at least, I've been able to do a lot more of these book tours. So I want to just give a little bit of an explanation of why I wrote this book, which, by the way, is my first and last book. I'm not going to follow in Tom's footsteps and become a prolific author, or for that matter, I know many others of you here, because this was not necessarily a good time. But it was important for me to do, and this work is important. And the reason is a very personal reason. I have had what I call a checkered past. People politely say a varied past. But I've done a lot of different things in my life, none of which were in government. So I was born in Budapest in 1954, and we came to the U.S. in 1956 when I was two during the Hungarian Revolution. I grew up in Los Angeles, and I went to Tufts and Fletcher, and then I spent 30-plus years in the private sector. I was an investment banker. I worked at McKinsey for a little bit. But I was an entrepreneur and started several businesses, and like all good entrepreneurs, most of them were miserable failures. There was one that was successful, which what allowed me to move to Lincolnville, Maine a few years ago, and that is a television satellite company that is now the largest commercial television satellite system in the world, based in the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg, called Société Européenne des Satellites. And it is a 16 billion market cap company that distributes 6,200 channels of audio, video, and data. It broadcasts all of the commercial cable channels, basically, outside of North America, everything from CNN to Al Jazeera to B-Sky B. It's also the backhaul for the SWIFT interbank system that processes all of the settlements by the world banking system. That was my one successful venture. I had a great many unsuccessful ventures whose stories are less interesting to you, but they were very informative to me. And then I had one straight job, really, which was for a decade. I was at Warner Brothers in Los Angeles, which is my hometown, where I was head of strategy and then eventually head of the operating committee at Warner Brothers, which at that time was the largest entertainment company in the country. I left all of that, moved to Lincolnville, Maine, from Beverly Hills, California, which was an obvious move. I mean, there was a big moving truck going, and I could get a great deal, and so we just chipped in and we moved to Lincolnville. And I was planning on, you know, doing interesting things like going to this event, which, by the way, it was because of the presence of people like you that I found the Mid-Coast to be especially interesting and exciting, because it had what I called an intellectual and cultural life far in excess of its population and what you'd think. So that was one of the reasons. I didn't have a grandfather who had a camp on a lake here. I didn't do Outward Bound. I didn't do any of that stuff, and I'm not from New England. So this was kind of an accident, and I've made some of the closest friends in my life here. But I was, all my life, I have been, had an avocation in as a history buff, and I couldn't understand my father, who passed away about 15 years ago and became a very successful academic in California, was obsessed with learning about the war. Both of my parents were children in the camps, and then, of course, there was the revolution. And so there was he always used to say, I was in it, but I never understood what was going on. And then he spent most of the rest of his life trying to figure that out. And what I learned from him was that the most awful thing that can happen in life are the political, violent political upheavals that destroy entire cultures and societies. We're seeing it today in Syria. And I then spent a lot of time, including in college and grad school, trying to understand, you know, what that was about. And I came to the conclusion that economics underlies all politics, which probably many of us here already knew and agreed with. But within that, what I realized was that it's actually joblessness that is the most significant part of the economic equation. After I left the State Department, where I was started this program that Tom talked about, I decided to write this book based at a think tank in Washington, the Brookings Institution, who also published the book, as well as running a consulting firm that does entrepreneurship development around the world. And the basic motivation for this, and the reason I left Lincolnville and went to D.C., was that I had the opportunity, not a political appointee, but in a program called the Franklin Fellowships, which, like a lot of things at the State Department, is a really great idea, miserably executed. But it was basically, the idea was to bring people with non-government experience. So you had to have, I call it old people, but they called it experienced people with 20 or more years of non-government experience. So you could have been a ballet dancer, you could have been a ski instructor, you could have been a trombone player, or you could have been an entrepreneur in my case. And so I went down there and I took up this post, which was very exciting, volunteer, unpaid, 100 hours a week. And started this program, the Global Entrepreneurship Program, which started just before Tahrir Square. And the basic idea came from President Obama's Cairo speech, which was his first major foreign policy speech, as you may recall, which he gave at Cairo University in June of 2009. And he talked about how the United States needed to change the way we interact with the Muslim world, and it can't only be terrorism all the time. And one of the things that we should do, there were many ideas he had, but one of them was that we should address one of the biggest problems in the Muslim world, which is joblessness. And one of the best ways to do that is through entrepreneurship, which is my mantra. And so I got so excited by that that I went down to D.C. and started this program, and then eventually that gave rise to this book. So the basic concept of my work for the last 8 years has been that there's a straight line connection between entrepreneurship, job creation, political stability, and peace. And, you know, the notion is that entrepreneurship is the single best way to create jobs, and jobs is the single most consistent explanation for violent conflict. And I will talk a lot more about that, but that's what a lot of the research for the book is about. So with that sort of overview as a headline, let me just, you know, quickly run through some of the basic concepts of the book. First is my definition of an entrepreneur. We all have our own, but mine is it's a person with the vision to see a new product or process and the ability to make it happen. And I just want to unpack that a little bit because in the work I do in developing countries, I've worked in about 36 developing countries doing entrepreneurship development since I left Lincolnville 8 years ago. This definition is different than it is in the United States, and it's very important. For example, process innovators are as important, if not more important, than product innovators. The analogy I use is that Starbucks didn't invent coffee. They changed the process for selling coffee. More people work for Starbucks in Silicon Valley in Santa Clara County than work for Google worldwide. Starbucks is not a tech company. And they didn't invent coffee. It's a process innovation. Another one of my favorites, which is in the book, is quinoa, right? How many people know what quinoa is, right? We live in Maine, so we're all about organic food. So quinoa, of course, is a grain that's been eaten by the Incas since we know, 1,500 years at the minimum. And it was about a $35 million business 10 years ago. Today, it's almost a $3 billion a year business. Same quinoa. No difference in the quinoa. Entirely a change in the process for selling the quinoa, which came about because of entrepreneurs. So it's very important to understand that process innovation is as important, if not more important, than product innovation. Second thing is that I'm very big on what I call no-tech, low-tech, as well as high-tech entrepreneurship. In the United States, we think of entrepreneurship as Silicon Valley and tech. And in point of fact, the examples I've just given you are examples of no-tech or low-tech. And in the developing world, it's almost always no-tech and low-tech. And the way you bolster no-tech and low-tech is different than putting a 20-year-old in a room in front of a computer with a headset on and a ping-pong table in the background. That is what we think of normally as turbocharging entrepreneurs, right? They're all 20, they all wear headsets, they all work at 3 o'clock in the morning, and they all play ping pong. Not in the developing world. So that's an important distinction in the work I do. And then the second part, which I found especially important when I went to Washington, is the ability to make it happen. You know, there's a saying among entrepreneurs, it was Tom Edison's first, that, you know, it's 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. And I learned when I went to Washington, and I'd never worked there before, and in fact, part of the book is a lexicon of what things mean in America versus what they mean in Washington. Because there was a whole new vocabulary I had to learn at the State Department coming sort of from business. But in Washington, a policy, right, is the sexy thing. So as long as we have the policy right, we're done, right? So we figured out that jobs is the problem, and we give a lot of speeches about it. The president had seven summits about it, the first two of which I planned. And we had these huge convenings, which in Washington are called a deliverable. And so we made a huge amount of progress because we talked about it a lot. In entrepreneurship, it's 99% about the execution. So having figured out the policy is 1%, that's great. Now you have to actually make it happen. And that's a very different mindset than in the public sector. So in America, entrepreneurs are the rock stars of our age. They are, you know, the fighter jet pilots, they are the movie stars, and it's very cool to be an entrepreneur. Everywhere else in the world, that is not true. Everywhere else in the world, being an entrepreneur is the last thing that you want to tell your parents if you come from a good family and had a good education. The last thing you want to say is, I'm not going to go work at the foreign ministry, which is usually number one. I'm not going to go work for Citibank or Barclays, which is usually number two. I'm not going to go work for a major multinational like McKinsey or ExxonMobil. I'm going to start my own company. And by the way, Mom and Dad, could I have $10,000, please? That's the last thing they want to hear. Entrepreneurs are totally disrespected. They are like the crabgrass that grows up in the cracks on a hot summer day between the bubbling asphalt and the broken glass and the used tires and the old beer cans. That's what entrepreneurs are like in the developing world. They exist everywhere. Crabgrass exists everywhere. And entrepreneurs exist everywhere. There's no place I've ever been, war zone, refugee camp, Rwanda post-genocide, Libya after Benghazi. There's no place in the world that doesn't have entrepreneurs. But they're crabgrass. And they have enormous problems, and they're not revered or sexy. So why is entrepreneurship important in a foreign policy context? This is especially important, including right now, because the accepted wisdom is that entrepreneurship is the far extreme of capitalism, and government is the enemy. And the goal of free market capitalism is to have either no government or as little government as possible. Is that familiar to any of you? And the research that I've done actually shows not only that that's not true, but that the opposite is true, that successful entrepreneurship requires the active involvement of government. And there are no examples of successful entrepreneurial ecosystems, including the United States and Israel, which are the two most successful in the world today, that were not led by the government. So I'll make that point as I go here. But the book has a chapter 3, that talks about a million reasons entrepreneurship is good for you. Don't worry, I'm not doing them all. But I am going to talk about a few of them. So the first most important one, obviously, is the jobs reason, which I've already talked about. There's a lot of research, including in the book, that links joblessness to violent extremism all over the world over hundreds of years of history. So while it is true that it has always been the root cause of major upheavals, including terrorism today emanating from the Middle East, it is also important to bear in mind that it has been true historically. So while these are the unemployment rates, and by the way, these are for men, because in none of those territories do they count women. But so the numbers, presumably, since women generally are more than half of the population, the number is presumably substantially larger. But I put Molenbeek up there because Molenbeek, of course, is the suburb in Brussels where the terrorists came from who tried to blow up Zaventem, the Brussels airport. And the fact of the matter is that high rates of youth unemployment precipitate violent breakdown in society everywhere. In 1932, 27% of German youth under the age of 27 were unemployed. The same is true when the Shining Path started in Peru. The same is true of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. The same was true in Rwanda, and I have an extensive case study about Rwanda in the book with respect to the genocide there. So it's very interesting that not only is economic extremists one of the key indicators of a society at the breaking point, but specifically it's joblessness, and specifically it's youth joblessness. And for those of us who live in Maine, we can probably relate to some of this because it's a big issue in Maine, which is why so many young people leave. So in the course of doing this work, I have the privilege of working with many, many amazing people. And the first program that I did at the State Department was in Egypt. There were three major programs I had, Egypt, Indonesia, and Turkey. So I was commuting between those three countries, coach class center seat, by the way. And then there were five additional countries, Lebanon, Jordan, Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco. So there were eight countries that we worked in. Egypt was the first, and I started there about 3 months before Tahrir Square, was there during Tahrir Square, and then for 2 years thereafter. And one of the people I met who was an extraordinary guy was this guy, Ahmed Al-Alfi, who's an Egyptian-American, who's probably single-handedly done more to turbocharge the startup scene in Cairo than any other person. He's started Flat Six Labs, which we co-funded very modestly, meaning the U.S. government. And it's today the only operating startup incubator in Cairo, which has 25 million people. And he's, you know, said it better than anyone ever could. We you know, about how important this is. Hernan de Soto, who I'm sure many of you know and his work you know, has made the same comment. The fact of the matter is, though, and this is the part that's a little more interesting because the jobless connection is pretty straightforward, and an audience that's this sophisticated probably already knows that. But there were a whole bunch of other things I learned that were really important benefits of entrepreneurship. One of them is that entrepreneurs, I learned, are the same person everywhere in the world. It's a bridge class of people. So whether they are in Portland, Maine, or in Cairo, or in Bridgetown, Barbados, or in Kumasi, Ghana, or in Bandung, Indonesia, they are the same people. And they are interested in the same thing. And one of the things that was especially interesting to me in the work I was doing at the State Department was, I'm a nice Jewish boy from Los Angeles. I had never been to a Muslim country. I'd lived in Israel for a year. I had a T-shirt. I kind of vaguely knew they existed, but I had no direct experience. I then spent 3 years exclusively in the Muslim world. And what I learned was that everyone I spoke to, particularly in the countries neighboring Israel, the one thing they wanted from me as a State Department person was not, please don't move the embassy to Jerusalem, was not, what is America's, you know, politics going to be vis-a-vis our country? It was, could you possibly invite us to the States where we could meet Israeli entrepreneurs and VCs because we know it's the most successful ecosystem in the world and we can see them from our roof, but we can't talk to them and we have a really great company we'd like to pitch. And that was a light bulb going on moment for me. And that was true everywhere in the world. So whether they were Sunnis or Shias, whether they were Irish Catholics or Irish Protestants, whether they were Hutus or Tutsis, regardless of the animosity that may have existed between groups, among entrepreneurs, there was a commonality. And that was very exciting. And so that's a huge reason from a foreign policy standpoint why this is such an important program. But there were others. One of the others was that entrepreneurship is often the only path up available to those not born to privilege, particularly women. So I worked for someone who educated me a lot about the power of women. And sure enough, in all the places that I worked, generally speaking, women were either totally excluded from the economy or very substantially disadvantaged. So entrepreneurship was one of the few avenues open to them. And for those of you who know about the microfinance world, which is a cousin to what I do, although it's separate, 99% of microfinance entrepreneurs are women. And it's not an accident. Another reason that entrepreneurship is really important is that it's one of the most important ways for societies to build wealth. An interesting finding I learned in researching the book was that in 1965, Jamaica and Singapore were basically the same country. If you were a Martian and you landed on Earth, the only difference you would see is that one was black and one was Chinese. But they were both islands. They have the same surface area. They had exactly the same population. And they had exactly the same per capita income. And by the way, they have the same climate. And they both speak English. And they were both British colonies. And they both used British currency. That was in 1965. Today, not so much. Today, there's a big difference between Singapore and Jamaica. Singapore being one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Jamaica being one of the poorest countries in the world, where I've just finished a World Bank project. I won't say that entrepreneurship is the only reason, but entrepreneurship and the development of a positive regulatory environment for business certainly is one of the things that drove that progress. And today you can't even compare whether it's literacy, whether it's infant mortality, whether it's any social indicator. You can't compare the two. Entrepreneurship is also a key element in rehabilitating fragile and destabilized states. So we have a lot of those, and the United States has been quite involved in creating some of them. In Rwanda, where I've done a lot of work, you know, Rwanda post-genocide 22 years ago was arguably the biggest basket case in modern modern world history. The average age in Rwanda in 1992 was 12. 80% of the men between 18 and 40 were dead. 75% of the women were HIV infected, and there were two medical doctors in Rwanda. Today, Rwanda has had the fastest growing economy in sub-Saharan Africa. The per capita income has quadrupled. It has citywide Wi-Fi in Kigali, which those of us who live in this part of the world would really give a lot for. And my favorite indicator of success is there's a new W hotel that just opened. So Rwanda has been an example of a society that is really transformed. And there, entrepreneurship was explicitly, the promotion of entrepreneurship and the resources that went into doing that were explicitly at the center of government policy. So entrepreneurship has a lot of benefits besides just job creation. It also happens to be about as American as apple pie. I mean, there are few things that Americans and those abroad agree are a hallmark of American culture more than entrepreneurship. In fact, even those who hate us the most, and I've been a lot of places and have met many of those people, respect our entrepreneurial know-how and want to find out how could we do that. So everywhere you go in the world, there's an effort to be the Silicon Valley of fill in the blank. So it's a huge arrow in our quiver. It's a huge advantage we have. So, of course, we are using it extensively in our foreign policy. Not so much. We spend 1% of 1% of the federal budget on entrepreneurship promotion. 1% of the 150 account, as it's called, which is the entire international affairs account that funds all organizations, starting with the State Department and USAID. It's about 1% of the federal budget, and of that, 1% goes for entrepreneurship development. We are solidly competitive with Australia in the amount of money we spend on entrepreneurship development. So Australia, which has 23 million people, which is 15 hours from anywhere, and which has 1/30th the GDP that the United States has, spends about the same amount of money as we do. We are bested by the giants of entrepreneurship, who are Sweden, the Netherlands, Germany, Canada, and the UK. So not only do we not spend very much money, but we spend it in typically efficient American fashion, which is there are 60 offices in 26 agencies in 12 different departments of the federal government who have entrepreneurship programs of one kind or another, of which mine was one. Not only is it not terribly well managed, but of the lion's share of funding, of course, goes through the USAID. And USAID, as many of you know who have worked in this space, is, you know, pretty widely agreed to be not only the least effective development agency in the world, but probably one of the least effective agencies in the U.S. government. A third of USAID's budget goes to three contractors. $35 billion a year is spent with three contractors, of whom the largest is Chemonix, which is a private company that does a minimum of $1 billion a year in USAID contracts, and was actually the company I worked with on my project in Egypt. So I had the pleasure of working with this contractor who knows as much about entrepreneurship as I do about doing open heart surgery on one of these tables right now. And they are consistently the largest single winner of USAID contracts. Why is that? Is that because people at USAID love Chemonix? No. They are universally reviled, and if you do a literature search, you'll find that there's nobody either inside or outside the agency that believes they're doing a great job. The reason why they're the largest, though, is because of the way that the U.S. government procurement and contracting system works. Over 65% of U.S. government programs are conducted by outside contractors. Outside contractors are hired using a procurement process that is embodied in the FAR, the Federal Acquisition Regulations, which is a 54-volume set of documents, each 2,000 pages long. And it is virtually impossible for anyone other than the usual suspects to get a contract. It's what I call the mouse dancing with a hippo syndrome. If you are not an existing contractor, and I, for example, have been a reviewer both for the State Department and USAID for these contracts, I myself would never in a million years apply as a private consultant now for one of these contracts. It would be impossible for me to ever win one. It would be impossible for me to ever execute it if I did win it. And certainly it would be impossible for me to achieve the kinds of outcomes that I seek. So the procurement system is a major problem. As I conclude here, to solve all of this, and the second half of the book is the solution. The first half is the reason why and the description of the problem. The second half is the solution. And the solution starts with the first premise, which is that unlike solving Sunni-Shia battles, unlike solving Protestant-Christian battles, unlike solving Hutu-Tutsi battles, most of which are way beyond my pay grade and people have spent a lot more time than I ever could trying to solve them, joblessness and the solution to joblessness through entrepreneurship is actually doable. You actually can do this. There are proven examples of programs that do, in fact, spur job creation through entrepreneurship. And I've developed what I call the 6+6 model for entrepreneurship ecosystem development, which is described in the book. And it basically says there's no one thing you can do. You can't just start a new venture fund. You can't just build a new business incubator. You can't just have a business plan competition. You have to do a combination of things. And there are 6 categories of activity: identify, train, connect, and sustain, fund, enable public policy, and celebrate entrepreneurs. And 6 categories of players: corporations, foundations, universities, NGOs, investors, and government, that must be knitted together in programs that actually move the needle, which is what I do in my consulting firm. And we do it in a 3-step process: diagnostic, design, and implementation. The diagnostic process is the same everywhere in the world. So whether you would look at the mid-coast of Maine or whether you would look at Ghana, which is what this is a map of, the diagnostic system that I use according to the 6+6 model is the same. And in doing the diagnostic, it's the analogy I use, it's just like being a medical doctor. Every single human being on the planet has exactly the same anatomy, biology, and chemistry. And the medicine cabinet of remedies is the same at any given moment in time. It obviously evolves, but at any moment in time, it's the same. Yet the treatment regimen for 2 people who have exactly the same ailment is never or almost never going to be the same. And the same is true with the work I do. The analytical aspect is the same. The list of remedies is the same. There are about 3 dozen programs that I work on that I deploy in or recommend be deployed in these countries. But the actual solution is different on a case-by-case basis. So what we would do in Maine, and I've been, you know, a little bit involved in with the Maine Center for Entrepreneurship Development, is, and Maine, by the way, has a lot of similarities to the developing countries I work in, except it's colder. But the particulars are very different. And so, for example, Maine draws on a market of 350 million people. Maine has the benefit of a regulatory environment. Maine has the benefit of a freely convertible currency. You know, on and on and on. A lot of the things are the same. And the question, therefore, becomes, you know, why is it the role of the government? And in my argument, it's the role of the government because it's the role of the government to do what the private sector can't do, won't do, and that's why we have public institutions. So the number one responsibility of government is defined in the Constitution, which has some good features, and today we're learning about some other features, is that to provide for the common defense. So the number one role of government is security. And the number one threat to the United States today is pretty widely agreed to be terrorism, pretty generally coming from non-state actors. Now, that may change, but that has been true since 9/11. So my argument is that if there's anything that your tax dollars are supposed to go for, it is providing the common defense and creating a stable and peaceful society in which we can all live our lives and grow our businesses, grow our minds, grow our artistic abilities. So therefore, it is the responsibility of government to do that. In Iraq and Afghanistan, since the beginning of the wars, we've spent about $2.5 trillion. We have lost about 25,000 U.S. lives, 60,000 Allied troop lives, an untold number of civilian lives, but certainly more than 250,000. We've created more than 8 million refugees who are in the process of destabilizing Europe more than at any time since the Second World War. The youth unemployment rate in Iraq and Afghanistan is today 125% of what it was before we helped in that way. My argument is that maybe some of that $2.5 trillion should have been spent on programs that would create jobs. And maybe we would be in a different place than we are today. So four basic solutions: funding, organization, procurement, and people. I suggested that we increase the amount of funding we devote to this, which is a comment that I make everywhere I go. It's that we improve the way we manage these programs. I've suggested that we reformat an agency called the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, OPIC, to be the lead agency for private sector development, and that we take all of the money that is in all of these other places I mentioned and focus it in one place. And that one place does a number of things, including bring in people who have some experience in this. I've advocated for a Peace Corps for entrepreneurship that uses the extraordinary talent Americans who, generally speaking, are interested and ready, willing, and able to do this many times for free. Stanford has an amazing program that uses free mentors, and they rotate 8 people through Ghana every 6 months, and they've been doing it for 3 years. And they have a waiting list of, 200 names. And that's one school in one country. That we change the procurement, particularly with respect to including entrepreneurial and innovative companies, in a way that allows them to actually win some of these contracts, because surprise, surprise, some of the greatest innovations in entrepreneurship come from small, innovative, entrepreneurial companies and not necessarily from the usual suspects. So the book is a plea for this. I personally think that it's very much a bipartisan plea. I think that an administration that's headed by an entrepreneur probably is also interested in entrepreneurship, just as the previous administration was, which supported the work that I was doing. So for me, this is a topic that is as viable today as it was before the election. We'll see whether or not that proves to be possible. So thank you so much for listening, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Stephen. Wow. I don't know whether to be hopeful from what you've said about Rwanda or depressed from what you've said about our procurement establishment, but a bunch of questions here. It seems to me part of what you're proposing assumes a certain level of trickle-down. I mean, it's not enough that an entrepreneur sells bottles of water in a refugee camp and supports himself, but somehow it's got to support people other than the entrepreneurs themselves. Doesn't it seem to you that trickle-down doesn't work as well as it used to? And what should we do about that?
Well, I would call it trickle-up because it starts at the bottom rather than at the top. And one of the things I would also note is if you take the example of quinoa, which I gave earlier, and there are many other examples. I talk in the book about an amazing entrepreneur I worked with who was in the cut flowers business in Java. And we increased their business tenfold by extending the range of where he could ship flowers to. What that did is it increased 50-fold the number of farmers from whom he bought. The same is true in the quinoa industry. So for every entrepreneur, there are 50, 100, 1,000 people who have jobs that are created for them. And one of the things I always say when I talk to groups about, entrepreneurship is that, there's one entrepreneur and then there are hundreds of people who are working for that entrepreneurial company and thousands of people who are affected. So if you look at eBay, how many people have been able to start to sell products? What has been the effect of that on society? And though it obviously did enrich the entrepreneur who was at the head of that business, that's a whole industry that never existed before. And that and there are thousands, if not tens of thousands of people who now make their livelihood, particularly in remote places like Maine, because you can be an eBay entrepreneur anywhere. So I don't agree that it's a top-down. I think it's a bottom-up approach, because entrepreneurs start at the bottom. And I also don't believe that it is limited in its scope, because they create opportunities for others.
I have to interrupt for this one. Is your book as clear and brilliant as your talk? If so, I'll buy it.
I hope you recorded that for your grandmother so you could tell her.
Well, we have an audience here who's clearly been scarred by the recent election, so many of the questions are about that. Are the people coming into the Trump administration sympathetic to your ideas of entrepreneurship, or to any ideas?
Well, of course, this is the $64,000 question. I'm an inside the tent rather than outside the tent kind of guy. So I believe in this country. I believe in this system. I believe that we have one president at a time. And it just so happens, as a business person, the U.S. government is by far and away the largest check writer in the American economy. So I'm going to try. I have a little bit of baggage, but I know someone who once voted for Trump. And I do believe, I really do believe, that we have yet to see what the full complement of appointees looks like. But I can tell you that I've been working pretty hard, and Brookings is a fairly bipartisan think tank. So I spend a lot of time on the Hill with both sides of the aisle, and there's a pretty significant bipartisan congressional interest in this subject. I don't know what the administration is going to look like, but the answer is I certainly am going to try.
Will bringing more business people into government, will it help?
Well, as I get older, I'm sure that there are many others who will relate to this in the audience besides young people like my son. But as you get older, you realize that, you know, there are very few things that are black and white in life. Most things are gray. There's no absolute yes or no. There's no clear-cut right answer, wrong answer. It's usually somewhere in between. And I think one of the benefits, and the book is very critical of the State Department and USAID and this administration, in which I was proud to serve, but in which I found a great many faults. Maybe the new administration will give a chance to fix some of those things that needed fixing. And I absolutely believe that the notion of the program that I was brought into the State Department in, the Franklin Fellowship Program, the State Department is very solidly rooted in 1983. And there's an enormous amount of, you know, I mean, I wrote a blog about this during the email campaign. I didn't understand why everybody was so exercised about Hillary's emails, because the email system in the State Department does not work. All of us went outside the building to send emails. Anybody who has worked in the State Department knows you cannot work within the IT structure of the State Department. So there's a coffee shop across the street called Casey's, which is where everyone goes to do anything significant. Because otherwise, you could spend 2 days just figuring out how to unlock your secure server. So, you know, those are things that have to change. And I hope that maybe this administration will change them.
About Rwanda, how much did strongman leadership of Kagame with U.S. support really have to do with Rwanda's rapid recovery?
Well, you know, this is a great question, and it's true of Lee Kuan Yew, obviously, in Singapore, and it's true of several other examples around the world. It had a lot to do with it. My argument is it's about good governance. The absence of a robust democracy in Rwanda, I think, is a problem. But to be perfectly frank, in the last couple of months, the United States has lost among other things, the ability to preach to the rest of the world about how to run a democracy. So I actually think that we need to be more humble about how we tell people to, you know, do as we do, because I don't think we're necessarily doing all that well.
There is a small business administration in the United States. What can you say about that?
Well, there is a small business administration in the United States, and it was headed by a Mainer, Karen Mills, who I think the world of. And they are an example in, and I use many of their programs as an example in the countries in which I work. In my world, which is exclusively international and in developing countries, the SBA is precluded by law from working. So there are no direct SBA programs that work internationally. There are programs where we bring people from abroad to the U.S., and they observe and they learn and they visit SBA development centers, of which there are hundreds across the country, several in Maine. But SBA itself is not an outward-looking
agency. But Stephen, I think the question really was, is it doing in the United States the sorts of things that do create a climate for entrepreneurism?
Yes. I mean, I think the SBA does a lot of great stuff, and I think it is a successful agency. Is it as efficient as it could or should be? Probably not. Are there people who've had bad experiences? Yes. But are there people who, including myself, who've gone in and looked at some SBA programs? The SBIC, the Investment Credit Program, there's a lot of documentation about how important that has been to small business in the U.S. and training programs. So, yes, I think the SBA is a successful agency that could be more successful, but is, worth emulating.
As a self-confessed member of the U.S. oligarchy yourself, what can you tell us about the maldistribution of wealth in the United States?
Well, first, I would say I'm an aspirational member. So I am not. So I just went on this tour. I'm doing a world tour of oligarchies. I went to Hungary, which I have a special place for. I plan to go to Tajikistan and Belarus and Turkey and all of the great oligarchies and see what we can learn from them. I think that it goes back to this all things being black and white. You throw out the baby with the bathwater when you dismiss all entrepreneurs as oligarchs, all entrepreneurs as, you know, being sort of selfish capitalists and providing no benefit to society. What do societies look like where everyone is employed by the state? In Greece, 50% of the population is employed by the state. In the Soviet Union, 100% of the population was employed by the state. So for me, you know, state employment, and I'm a Hungarian refugee having fled during the revolution. So I have a bias, but I don't believe that state employment is the answer. I do believe that that private industry needs to be encouraged, and I believe that entrepreneurs are the ones who do that, and they're not all bad by any stretch of the imagination.
We have a couple of questions about the new appointee for the State Department, Tillerson. What do you foresee there?
I don't know him. I am going to try to. My big concern is whether or not anyone in the current administration is going to care about international economic development or peace and security, including him. It has been a non-topic. The landing team has not even arrived at USAID. You know, in the transition, there's a landing team that goes to each agency. This administration, which is very much an inside the beltway kind of thing, but this administration is unprecedented in the delay of having actually even shown up a large number of federal agencies. And the fact that they haven't shown up at all, not even assigned somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about, but just shown up at all, because usually they do the former at least, to me is not a good sign. So, and I will say also that this administration, there of the many, many things I disagree with, this administration clearly does not believe that the United States has an important role in reversing climate change. The incoming Secretary of State is not only spent 40 years in the biggest hydrocarbon company in the world, but he also has been on record repeatedly. And I don't agree with that, in part because of the places I travel to. And I see what, you know, I mean, I've been in Beijing on a day like today when nobody could go outside.
You know, Roosevelt had a program of the dollar a year men, all of whom came from business. And didn't they manage to do some good for our economy without simply profiting the businesses they had left behind?
I think that's a really great point. And yes, they did. And I think that there are other examples of that as well. I think that the Peace Corps itself and Sergeant Schreiber, and I think many of the Great Society programs in the Johnson era, all of those are examples of that. And I think we have an incredible ability in this country to do that. It's why I want to do this Peace Corps for Entrepreneurs, because I'm 99% sure, just based on the work I do myself, that half of the people in this room, which is a very sophisticated audience of people with extensive international background, I bet if I told you I could use you for an hour a week to do a Skype mentoring session with an entrepreneur in Ghana in an area that you know about, I bet half the people in this room would sign up for free.
We've run out of time. I'm going to send you home with homework of a handful of additional questions. One more to for you to chew on. Will your model of creating an ecosystem for entrepreneurship, would it work in rural Maine? How would you begin?
Well, that's one of my favorite subjects. I'm extremely devoted to this place. And we are making considerable progress, actually. You know, when, even in the short time I've lived here, and I know I'm from away, I'll always be from away, and so I'm from away. But in the short time I've been here, the change has been extraordinary. Portland, southern Maine, so it's not rural Maine, it's not the mid-coast, it's not the county, but it's southern Maine, it's almost transformed. There were no incubators. There are now three. Portland has become one of the sort of hot, small startup cities in America, which none of us would have believed who were involved in working on this. Maine Angels was almost defunct, and now it is the most active angel group in New England. You know, I went down there with my very good friend Des Fitzgerald in probably the first year I lived here, and, you know, they did one deal that year. They're doing three or four a month. And they're all, I would say two-thirds of them, not all, but two-thirds of them are Maine companies. So the ecosystem in Maine is taking off. Now, entrepreneurship ecosystem development is hyper-local. What works in Portland does not work in Rockland. What works in Accra, Ghana, does not work in Tamale. And one of the big problems is you have to look at the ecosystem locally. So the mid-coast, Rockland to Belfast, is a whole different kettle of fish, as all of us know. You know, you can't get here from anywhere. You, generally speaking, you know, we are anti-business, or at least we have to ask thousands of questions. We are pretty much anti-growth. We have the highest electricity rates in America. We have the worst internet connectivity in the 48 contiguous states. So we have a lot of issues that stand in the way, but those are all examples of things that can be changed and are slowly being changed and were changed in southern Maine. So I am optimistic.
We'll leave it there. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you. You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. If you missed all or part of today's Speaking in Maine, the program is available on our website, mainepublic.org, where Speaking in Maine is available for streaming and as a podcast. Charles Beck is the executive producer for Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Woodward.